the CDRS detectors, how they work, and why we're building them the way we do. Then I'll talk about our recent results that's been published. First, we showed them last year, finally published beginning of this year. Then I'm talking a little bit about analysis that's in progress at the moment, and where our future is with Super CDMS. First, to the CDMS detectors. In our case, the basic idea is that we measure the interaction energy. If part of it interacts, eventually most of the energy is transferred into thermal energy. So we want to take advantage of this thermal energy. To be able to measure the thermal energy, we need to go to very low temperatures. That's why we call CDMS or cryogenic dark matter search. So we have our target, and we put on a phonon sensor. The main feature of our detectors is that besides the thermal signal, we measure a second signal. The material that we use is germanium, that's a semiconductor. If a particle interacts, it produces electron hole pairs. And the number of electron hole pairs per energy is much larger in electron recoils than nuclear recoils. So if we apply an electric field and collect the charges, we get different size pulse for electron and nuclear recoils. And that's what we use to discriminate our background. So we've got the recoil energy on the x-axis, the ionization energy on the y-axis. So we irradiate the detector with neutrons and gammas, and we see these two bands. And we see this very nice separation between the nuclear recoils, which is eventually our signal, and electron recoils, which comes from all kinds of background radiation. And well, that's the main power of the CDMS detectors, that we have such a nice event-by-event discrimination. How do our detectors look like? They are the detectors that we have operated so far, about 7 centimeters in diameter and 1 centimeter thick. They have the germanium detectors have a mass of about 250 grams. We have also a few silicon detectors. Since the density of silicon is lower, they have 100 grams for the same volume. What you see here, the structure on the surface of the detector is the thermal sensor. And the thermal sensor is mainly a tungsten film. And the tungsten is a superconductor. And we operate in the transition from the superconducting region, where we have zero resistance, to the normal region, where we have a finite resistance. And that's in the 1 to 2 ohm range for our detectors. And so in this transition range, which has a width of, well, roughly 10 millikelvin or so, we have a very strong dependence of the resistance on the temperature. And so we can measure the temperature increase from the particle interaction by measuring the resistance. And so we call this type of sensors transition edge sensors, because that's this transition edge. We operate the detectors, well, the transition temperature is somewhere between 50 and 100 millikelvin, typically 80 millikelvin. What we do, we operate the detectors actually somewhat lower in temperature. And we need to apply a current to read out the detectors. And so what we actually do is we drive the detectors into the transition knot just by temperature, but we put the temperature here and apply a current and reach the critical current for the detector. So the operation temperature is 14 millikelvin. We have, actually, this is not one sensor. It's divided in 4 sensors. Actually, there is about 1,000 of these transition edge sensors in each of the quadrants, and they are all wired in parallel. And so we read out 4 signals from these transition edge sensors. On the back side of the detector, we have aluminum electrodes, which we use to read out the charge signal. So the thermal sensor acts as ground reference for the charge measurement. You see the electrode is divided in an inner disk and an outer ring. One of the problems is that the electric field at the outer edge of the detector is not completely homogeneous, and so the charge signal that we would get from events at the edge of the detector would be somewhat lower, so we basically cut out the edge of the detector by implementing this extra electrode, and we just discard events that happen in this outer electrode. So from each detector now we get 6 signals, and that's one sample event. So the fast small signal here is the charge signal, and that's the black one is the charge signal from the inner electrode, and the small red one is from the outer electrode, so it's a good event, it's in the center of the detector. And then these 4 signals that you see here is the 4 signals from the thermal readout, and what you see is that they look, the 4 different pulses look quite different, they have different amplitude, but they also have a different shape, so they have much steeper rise here, rising edge than those, but you also see there is a difference as to when the pulses start, and this comes from basically the propagation of the phonons in the crystal, and so this event took place under this sensor here, so it gets the highest amplitude. It's this sensor, sensor A, and the sensor which is farthest away, the sensor C, is on the opposite side. The phonons just take a certain amount of time before they reach the sensor, that's this offset here, and then you also get a slower rise. So we can use this information, the pulses, to identify where these pulses happen in the detector. A few things to the performance of the detectors. That's the discrimination, the main discrimination. Now, the recoil energy on the x-axis and the y-axis. Now, it's the ratio between the charge and the phonon signal. So what was the diagonal bands before become now horizontal. And you can see this nice separation. Unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. We irradiated one of our detectors with an intense beta source. Now you see you have this big mess here in between the gamma band and the neutron band, which seems to come from the beta source, but we understand what it is. If we have an interaction taking place, we build this initial charge cloud, and what we usually do is we apply an electric field and we collect the charges. The charges drift through the detector, and the drifting charges produce our charge signal. However, if this initial cloud, charge cloud, happens very close to a surface, could happen that, for example, if this is a positive electrode, could happen that some of the positive charge carriers enter the electrode in this initial cloud. They are hot, so they before they feel the electric field, they are here. They don't drift anymore through the detector, so they are lost for the signal. And that means an event which should be up here loses some of its charge and drops down. So this is our surface effect, and that is our main, which creates in the end our main background. We see we can remove the gamma events that are up here very easily from the nuclear records, but these beta events, they drop down and they leak eventually in the nuclear record region. And that's our main source of background. However, turns out that there is a very nice handle that we have, because it's not only that the charge is reduced for the surface events, but they are also considerably faster in the timing, and that has to do with the phonon interaction in the metallic surface layer. So we have here looked for what's the best discriminator, what we came up with in our early analysis, combination of delay with respect to the charge pulse and the rise time, and that's what I call here just the timing parameter. And now the y-axis is the same as here, so down here you have the neutrons, up here you have the gamma events, and the surface events which are in here, which are our problem, you see they are all very, very fast. So if you apply a cut in this timing parameter, we can basically get a clean sample of nuclear recoils without any contamination from the surface events. And that's what we eventually want. We want just nuclear recoils. A few more words on the timing. I mentioned the position determination. Again, a sketch of our detector. In one measurement, we put a collimator and a radioactive source in front of the detector, and we use the delay with respect to the charge faults in the different sensors to determine where the event took place. You see how nicely you can reconstruct the position of the different sources in the front of the detector. This works relatively well in the, towards the center of the detector. At the edge of the detector, it's not working so terribly well. And this is from a different calibration where we irradiated the detector homogeneously. And we cut out a wedge of the detector in this type of plot where we use the delay to the transient position. So we cut out a wedge here. And what we plot here, the y axis is the same radius that you have seen in the plot before. On the x axis, we have a radius parameter which we just take from the different amplitudes of the pulses. And what you can see is that there is a degeneracy. If we just look at this radius, the real radius of the detector goes along this, we call it a shrimp. So if we just look at this radius, you see it folds back. And it's difficult to produce these large surface area sensors completely homogeneously. So there is some dependence on the detector response on the position of the event in the detector. And that's why we need this position reconstruction. And we actually apply a position-dependent calibration for several of our quantities. That is the energy response, but also the rise time and the delay response, which is important for our discrimination. And we do that by doing high-intensity calibrations. And then for each event which we observe in our final measurement, we locate it in XY and in the shrimp plot and in a number of other parameters, and look at the energy response and rise time response of calibration events that happen in the immediate surrounding in this parameter space. And then we adjust or we determine the calibration factors depending on the neighboring events that we observe in the calibration measurement. In this case, the color code is the rise time of the pulse, and you see that in the center of the detector, the rise time is somewhat slower, and at the edge of the detector, definitely much slower. And so we can account for that, and then we can retain this nice discrimination. Okay, we take our detectors, we put them in bunches of six, and build what we call a tower. Then it's pretty dark, I'm sorry. Then we put some electronics on it, and eventually we want to make it cold. So we need to cryostat. This provides low temperature. We also want it low in background, so we need shielding around it. So instead of putting the detectors directly into the cryostat, we have this cold box here connected with a cold thinner. And so this is our cold volume for detectors now, surrounded by lead and polyethylene shielding against neutrons and gamma. Gamma radiation, that's a picture from almost not to see. In the back here, when we set up the system, in the back is the cryostat. This is the lower part of the polyethylene shielding. This is the lead shielding surrounded by polymeric foil to prevent radon played out. Okay, that's where our detectors live. That's now a top view into this cold box. We have five of these detectors installed here, and here is after we implemented all the electronics. These five detectors correspond to about 5 kilograms of germanium and 1 kilogram of silicon. And the whole setup operates in the Sudan underground mine in Minnesota. We have operated from 2006 to 2009. And we have published our first set of data taken until June 2007. We had about 400 kilogram raw exposure, an analysis threshold of 10 kilograms. Main analysis steps that we do is, I mentioned we have this position-dependent calibration, mainly of the energy and the timing performance, which in the end give our main discriminators. we remove periods of bad detector performance, and this includes some of the detectors which over the time have lost one of the other sensors. If that's happening, we don't use these detectors anymore for dark matter search. However, we also we know that WIMP will never interact more than once in our detector, so we remove multiple scatters. I didn't mention that we have muon veto around our setup, so as to remove cosmic ray related events. And so we use all the 30 detectors to determine if there's double scatter. And so all detectors work, but we don't use all of them for dark matter reading. And so this is what our data looked like in the end. So we did a blind analysis. We covered the region of interest generously so that we are not biased in determining our cuts. We determined all our cuts, and this is what we see. You see this gamma band, and then you see all these events here, and that's all the surface events. So we need to apply this timing cut that I mentioned before, and if we do that, we remove everything here, almost everything, and at the last step, we calculate what our expected background would be from leakage from the remaining surface events that we didn't cut out. And we came up with 0.6 plus or minus 0.5, roughly. It's not actually the uncertainty is slightly asymmetric. So that's our estimated background. And after cuts, we made with 120 kilogram days of exposure. Then we removed the blinding, and we found no events, which is on one hand very nice because we didn't have any background. On the other hand, of course, it said that we didn't see waves. I want to show one more plot. That's the same y-axis again. On the x-axis now, we have this timing parameter. And yellow is where we would expect our neutrons to be. And you see that all the events that we saw in the first plot that rain down are these fast surface events. And you see we cut fairly conservatively here with our timing. So if we would have been a little more aggressive, we could have increased our exposure by maybe 20 to 30% or so. Anyway, this is the cut that we decided beforehand, and that's what we used for determining our WIMP limit because we didn't see the result. We have seen this type of plots before, but some of the other experiments, I maybe have here the cryogenic experiments, and Xenon, because Xenon has the best limit before we published these results, and the results, our results are sitting here, so about 45 GeV WIMP mass, that's the most sensitive experiment at the moment. And that's for spin-independent scattering, and we also determined a cross-section for spin-dependent scattering. In this case, neutron spin is the relevant. We don't have unpaired protons, and the minimum is at the same mass, but it's at 2 times 10 to minus 2 picobar. That's because we don't have the coherent enhancement for the spin-dependent. We have only about 6-7% of germanium-73, so it's not a huge fraction of spin target that we have in there. And so for the spin dependent, the xenon is more sensitive than we by a factor of roughly 2. Just quickly want to mention, we also analyzed our data. We looked at the electron recoil events, and that was somewhat triggered by the gamma experiment, because they proposed that there might be other interpretations of their positive signal. So we looked if we can say anything about that. The interesting part, we looked at different things. One is solar axions. We have crystal detectors, and we know exactly their crystal orientation. So we can look for axions from the sun. They would convert in the strong electric field of the nucleus. And due to the defined crystal orientation, we could have a strong enhancement if we fulfill the Bragg condition. And we can calculate that over the day, and that's the energy, and the intensity here gives the relative count rate that you would expect. So you see this distinct structure that's calculated for a particular coupling constant. just to illustrate how it would look like. And we can use this very well-known structure that you would expect to deduce some limits for the coupling constant, this axial gamma-gamma coupling constant. And even though the experiment was never designed to do anything like that, it gives fairly competitive limits here. It's not the best one, but it's an interesting range, and we believe that if we increase our exposure and next generation reduce our background, we can probably push that down by a factor of a few. Now, if you compare with a few kilogram, the gamma is in a 100 kilogram range, so even though we have much, much smaller mass, we are quite close to that. We also looked at relic axions. In this case, we don't know the direction, so we don't have this feature. So the only thing we can look at is the electron recoil spectrum as a whole. That's the low energy part. This range here, this peak, comes from activation of the germanium. So we have to avoid this region. We believe this slight enhancement might be due to cosmic activation production of iron-55 in our detectors. And so we just don't know what it is, so we cannot subtract it. So what we are looking for the relic axions, that would be a conversion of the axion into an electron, and that would give a peak at the mass of the axion. And so we look just for a peak above the flat background. And if we do that, we can, since we don't see any clear peak in this range, we think it might be background. We can only give a limit again. And this is then the limit for the axion-electron-electron coupling. And it's the lowest limit in the mass range where we are sensitive from any laboratory experiment. But there is cosmological or astrophysical limits which are a bit lower.
Sorry, do you see neutrino? I don't understand the solar neutrino line.
That's nothing to do with us. That's a limit on the on the coupling from solar neutrino measurements. Okay, so what are we working on right now is the remainder of the data, or at least the part that we've taken between July 2007 and fall 2008. We have that would increase the total, will increase the total exposure by roughly a factor of 3. So if we take then the combined data set. We have done quite some improvements in the data analysis. We have improved our data quality cuts. We improved or working on the improvement of the algorithm to do this position-dependent calibration. One of the things that we did in the past is, I mentioned, we removed the edge of the detector with this outer electrode. And in the past, we have done that first and then done the calibration, which led to some imperfections in the calibration at the outer part of our sensitive volume. What we are doing now is we first do this position-dependent calibration and then remove the outer edge, which should give a more homogeneous response at the, towards the edge of the fiducial volume. In order to stay background free, if we wouldn't change anything in our analysis, we would have to tighten the cuts, because now we already had 0.6 events expected leakage. If we increase our exposure by a factor of 3, that would turn into roughly 2 events. So we need to tighten the cuts, which would reduce our efficiency, our total efficiency. However, we are working on improving our timing analysis as well. And so we hope we can retain the same fraction of final exposure relative to raw exposure. But how much that will turn out to be remains to be seen. We definitely plan to announce our results in summer. We hope for talk. We are not perfectly sure if we can manage. There's a lot still to do. And the expected improvement will be somewhere in the sensitivity factor 2 to 3. Okay, that's where we are. There is as many expected regions as theoretical physicists are working in this field, or maybe even more. This is a particular region that I like to show. Here the group involved they try to determine the probability that a certain theory applies, which is always difficult to do. But instead of taking fixed experimental values, they took all the experimental values, parameters that determine the parameters in supersymmetry with their uncertainties and calculated the likelihood surface. And that's what they came up with. So the dark regions are the more likely ones. And we are really with our next data set, we are starting to stretch in this really interesting region. And I really don't want to say more than this, that we are really at the edge of being probing very interesting parameter space. Not saying that this is the final answer, and that's where the dark matter will be. That, of course, depends on the priors that you put and so on. However, to cover this region, we need to go down here in the tunnel range. And so we are working towards that from CDMS to super CDMS. How much time do I have left? 15 minutes. Okay, that's comfortable.
So I don't 10 minutes.
Actually. 10 minutes, okay. Yeah, I think I don't need to talk so fast then. So that's our original detectors. We have developed new detectors, which are 2.5 times as massive to it, and that's basically just a different thickness, which has several advantages. First of all, we reduce the number of readout channels per month. Also, as we've seen before, our main background is surface events close to the electrode. If we increase our thickness, we reduce the relative abundance of the surface events if we don't change anything else by the same factor. Also, you see that the structure on the surface here looks quite different. So we improve the design of the thermal readout, which should give a better tiling performance due to the larger coverage of the surface area. And also, we change the layout of the sensors. That was how we had them split up in four sensors before. Now we have this way to split the detectors. Having this outer rim gives us a better handle on the edge, on the events close to the edge. Especially in the thicker detectors, it's more difficult to localize the events in radius with just the charge signal. And so we have built the first set of these detectors. We still arrange them in towers. Now that's one of our old towers, that's the new tower. One important point is to determine our surface event contamination. The best handle we have on that is that our detectors, as you see, they are closely packed, so they are facing each other. So we look at double scatter events between neighboring detectors. And that turned out, at the beginning, we weren't clear that this would be so powerful, but it turned out to be the most powerful way to determine the detector response to electron recoils close to the surface, and also to determine what the expected background would be. So we can do that for the four detectors in the middle, but for the detectors at the edge, they have only one neighbor, and it's more difficult to determine what the expected background is from surface events on the other side. And so in our analysis so far, we haven't actually used these edge detectors, or end-cap detectors, how we use them, for dark matter analysis, just as beta detectors. Now we have taken this experience into account for designing a new tower. The tower now actually has 7 detectors, 5 of the large ones in the center, and then we have 2 small ones at the top and the bottom, and they are basically read out with the same electronics, so we still have only 6 detector readout channels, but we combine the readout of this and that one and use those detectors only as beta detectors, and that increases our active mass in a tower from roughly 1 kilogram in case we had 4 germanium detectors in the center, to 3 kilogram per tower. Our short-term goal is to replace all the 5 towers by these new super towers, which would increase our active mass to 50 kilograms. We have taken out the first two towers. They were the towers with most detector failures and with the highest background. And we put in the first of these new super towers, as we call them, in the center here. And as of a week ago, the setup is actually cold, and we're starting the commissioning of the detectors, and hope we get some at least performance data very soon. Next step would be to increase the total target mass to somewhere in the 100 to 200 kilogram range. We also want to increase further from this 600 gram, which we have now per module, to larger mass. What exactly that would be remains to be seen. And long-term goal is, as I mentioned, we need about a ton to get down to cover most of the interesting range. And so this, of course, is something a decade down the road, probably. So what you see here in this plot is on the x-axis is the total exposure. On the y-axis is the cross-section that you can reach. This is where CDMS has been so far. And this dotted line down here is where we would be if we remain background free. At the moment, the published limit is here. What we hope to reach with our data that we're analyzing right now is this dashed line here. If we just continue with the setup as it is, we expect our sensitivity to level out off due to background. Eventually, the background comes in and we can't do anything about it. We have only that much discrimination, and so we need to improve things. And we think that with our new detectors, we reduced the volume to surface ratio. Also, we think we now can have better control of the surface contamination from radon. We are more careful in handling, and we improved the discrimination with the new sensor design. We believe at the present setup, we can go down by a factor of two here to this red line, which we would reach the 15 kilogram target mass at Sudan. But if we continue to operate this setup there, we eventually would run into background from cosmic radiation and also from contamination in our setup. So to be able to make use of the larger target mass, as I mentioned that we are planning for, we need to build a new cleaner setup, and we need to go deeper to reduce cosmic radiation. And so our plan is to move to SNOWLAB. This is, we have seen a lot of this type before. That's the effective shielding. That's the muon flux that you have. That's where we are right now. And that's where SNOWLAB is. So we would use the muon flux by that, by about three orders of magnitude. And there's already space allocated for the experiment. That's a nice part. There's no money allocated yet. That's not so nice part. But we hope to get some positive response soon. Okay, and so when we move SNOWLAB with 100 to 200 kilograms, we hope to reach this kind of sensitivity a few times, 10 to minus 46 square centimeter, or 10 to minus, that would be, 10 to minus, that's 5, that's 10 to minus 6, that would be 10 to minus 10 picobar. Okay, in conclusion, I don't need to tell you that dark matter is a very interesting field. CDMS is presently the most sensitive experiment for the coherent scattering, so it's been independent, above 45 GeV. We expect significant improvement in our sensitivity very soon, in a few weeks. And our medium-term goal is to move to SNOWLAB with 100 to 200 kilogram detector mass. And let me conclude with this plot again. Look at it. It's really a very exciting time. We can expect to see something. Well, we are close to a very interesting parameter range right now, and we're reaching this in the next couple of years. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.